This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. It is our brainwave segment this month. And as usual, joining us is neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar. How are you doing today, Dr. Azlina?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Doing okay. You know, it's quite strange that it's already November. So, you know, there's only 1 month plus left to the year. So I guess we'll see what 2021 holds for us still this year.
I know, time flies, yeah.
And I guess, you know, for our second last episode of the year, we are talking about something quite interesting. And it's something that we very briefly talked about with you back in 2019. Mm-hmm. And that's the topic of mini brains or brain organoids, you know. And that's something that many scientists have been working on in the lab. But that begs the question, when people read these articles, the headlines, you know, are scientists really growing brains in a petri dish? You know, what is the purpose of such research? And of course, there's always the age-old question of whether can these brain organoids gain consciousness? You know, what are the ethics behind it? So joining us to discuss this topic today, together with Dr. Azlina, is Associate Professor Dr. Michael Ling, a developmental neurogeneticist from University Putra, Malaysia. How are you doing today, Dr. Michael?
I'm doing absolutely great.
So I think, you know, I gave quite, I guess, from what I understand, a very basic description of what brain organoids might be. But Dr. Michael, perhaps you could enlighten us a bit more. What are brain organoids?
So brain organoids are organoids, as many have actually perceived, is in your imagination. It could be, it looks like a small little brain that might be growing on a dish. And I have to say that is potentially a half-truth. There's half-truth. So although that we do have brain tissue that's growing on a dish, but this brain basically is still far from the actual functional human brain that we have in our head. So these brain organoids are, in fact, artificially grown tissue from mainly induced pluripotent stem cell. So they have to come from something. And these are usually comes from a stem cell that harvested from patients or any other people or individual where we have a great interest in terms of the biology of development, or as well as the development of a particular disorder the patient is having.
So it's not necessarily from healthy patients, but it could be patients with specific diseases as well.
Exactly, yes. And many has called it as mini brain. And I think we need to be very careful with the connotations, because the organoid is still far from being a full blown functional human brain. But it does resemble the primitive form of the brain during its early development. So we can still use it to study development, especially on various diseases where we can actually look into the developmental stages. Because at that time point, we don't even know the disease is basically exists in a particular patient. So it is extremely important, especially to study developmental disorder.
Hmm. I remember, you know, Dr. Azlina, you back then when you did the show with Shawik, you also said that calling it a mini brain is a misnomer, right? Because people then assume that, you know, you're growing an actual brain in the petri dish.
Yeah, it makes it sound scarier, I think, if you imagine. But actually, it's kind of like just a ball of cells, really. It doesn't really look like a brain. I mean, you're right. I mean, this topic we're revisiting after almost 2 years. I think it was December 2019. And I'm really happy to have Michael with us today, because he was still away on his postdoc, I think, at that stage. So it's really nice to have him back to revisit this topic 2 years on, and just to update what's been happening.
Perhaps I could ask you this, Dr. Azlina. I'll ask you first, you know, how are these cells, you know, these brain cells different from or perhaps similar to our own brains?
Well, I mean, that is the question, I think, that the scientists are trying to understand. I mean, for sure there will be differences, because when our brain grows inside the womb, you know, obviously you have it's a completely different environment. You know, and there are many things that when the brain grows naturally in the womb, that it's exposed to all the different factors and nutrients and signaling kind of, you know, proteins that tell the neurons to do this, that, and the other, and all the other cells as well. We don't know enough of that for us to recreate that outside a womb. So what the scientists are able to do is that we have a cocktail, right, of proteins, a mix of different really key important ingredients that we need to expose the cells to in order for them to develop into a neuron and to perhaps other cell types. But we don't know the full picture yet. And so that's kind of also what people are working on at the moment, trying to understand how to grow it better even so that it can mimic how the brain actually develops inside the womb. And then once it's developed, then of course, how the neurons function and communicate. Yeah. So there's still a lot that's unknown.
Dr. Azina, how large are these, brain organoids that scientists are growing in petri dishes?
Well, I'll let Michael answer that because he's actually done it. So he will know for sure.
So it started with a small pinhole size, to be honest, on day zero. But as the brain, that so-called, to make it simple, as the brain organoids grow up to day, up to 4 months to 6 months old, it can assume a size of about half a centimeter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're actually really very tiny.
They are very tiny, yes.
It's a pea. And is it like a pea shape?
It does not really have to resemble a pea shape, but generally is spherical in shape. Yeah.
It's spherical.
And depending on how they basically expand as you grow them, so sometimes some of these organoids may have lobed being produced, like a protrusions from the original spherical shape of the organoids. Yeah. But just to add on to Dr. Azlina's answer, how far can we or how far have we modeled the brain organoids as close as a human organoids, as far as the molecular characterization. So when we look into the gene expressions and the all these different markers, the brain organoids on the dish is now very much looks like the first trimester of how our brain is in fact in the womb. So as far as we are talking about the first trimester of development, the brain organoids can be very much likely looks like them.
And, you know, that brings me to another point on ethics, but I'm going to get you to hold on to that thought for a little bit, because first, you know, to the average layperson, right, who would just come across these headlines, you know, these very simple articles who describe what scientists are doing, how would you explain to them how, you know, you grow these brain cells in the lab? Because I think otherwise people's imagination would go right everywhere, right? People think of it like some sort of science fiction story.
So we started with the so-called stem cells. We know the stem cell is the ancestor cells of our body. So we can basically direct the stem cells to basically differentiate into the cell that we would like them to turn into. Mm-hmm. So the brain organoids started with an aggregate of these stem cells that basically grow in a pinhead size and they just forms like a bolus of cell, like Dr. Azlina just mentioned. And this is really small in size. We are talking about 9,000 cells to start with. And then by giving them the right environment, so the environment here is defined by a cocktail containing the right factors. And basically these factors will be able to direct them to slowly turn into the lineages, cell lineages that eventually differentiate into neurons, into astrocytes, into all the cells within the brain. Eventually, but this takes a very long time. So as we grow them up to 2 months old, 4 months old, or 6 months old, these organoids slowly will gain their size. And what they have in there is basically fluid fill, including neurons. We have astrocytes, but we also have undifferentiated cells that are slowly eventually differentiated into more neurons in the future. So at the end of the day, you get this a clump of cells, basically mainly constitute of neurons, that making interconnections among one and another. And are they really, you know, randomly place themselves within this organoid? So they are not. So the way that they actually grow basically resemble the very primitive development of the human brain at a very early stage. So they do arrange themselves into different layers, like the so-called germinal layers that keep on producing more daughter cells that eventually differentiate into neurons. And neurons are, of course, being placed at the outer layers within the organoid itself. So they do organize themselves into a specific layers that resemble the very early stages of development in human brain.
How long, do scientists usually allow these cells to grow for? Is it indefinite or are there, specific time frames?
due to resources, of course, we wouldn't want to grow them too long because it takes a lot. It involves a lot of manpower as well as money in order to provide continuously provide them these organoids. We call the very expensive media. So we do. We usually grow them for about a month or two, and then it depends on the stages that we would like to really study. It depends on our objective, and we will be able to stop the development and then and look at how the organoids looks like, and basically we dissect various informations, and as well as we try to extract the information from the organoids. But there are labs, for example, certain lab in the States, they basically grow the organoids as long as 1 year old to 2 years old, and they continue doing that and to see what is the limit and how far these organoids can go.
Dr. Azlina, is this how old is this field of research? You know, have scientists been working on this for many years?
Growing brain cells in a dish, yes, for decades. But it was always limited, as I mentioned earlier. Like you can grow neurons. You can take neurons from, say, an animal model, right, like a mouse or a rat, and you can take certain brain cells and you can grow them in a dish. But after a while, they're just not so happy. And so the maximum you can push them really, and correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, is about, 6 weeks or so. And then they sort of start to you can sort of see that they're not really so happy, and then eventually they will die, right? And then after that, then people thought about, okay, well, if we don't grow them as single cells, then how else can we grow them? Then people started to grow slices. So they would take the brain and then they would slice it, and then they would grow them as slices of brain tissue. But then that also kind of has a limit. And then there was also always a question, and Michael kind of touched on this, that if you want to study things like neurological diseases in a patient, right? But you can't take the patient's brain cells. So how do I recreate that patient's brain, right, outside the body? And so then because of other kind of advancements in the stem cell world, then people are now able to actually take something as simple as your skin cell, right, or even certain cells in the blood. And you can change that into a cell, a stem cell, which then you can turn them into a neuron or any other type of brain cell that you want. And so that's kind of how the field has sort of developed. You know, it's sort of like it started, a little bit. And then people said, okay, what if I want to get, actual patient samples and grow it? So now you can actually get a patient's blood sample or a patient's skin, and then you can then ultimately grow these brain organoids to really try to understand then how the disease develops. Right. And you can and that's really very powerful. And since the last time we spoke about it, over the last couple of years, there have been so many papers actually that have come out, now using this technique to look at things like, Parkinson's and motor neuron disease and even Alzheimer's, so you can see really that the application of this method has really just grown so exponentially in a relatively short period of time.
All right. Let's go for a quick break now, and we'll continue our conversation after a few quick messages. It is our monthly Brainwave segment with neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar. And joining us today is Associate Professor Dr. Michael Ling, a developmental neurogeneticist from University Putra, Malaysia. And we're discussing brain organoids, which are essentially brain tissues generated from stem cells. Correct me if I'm wrong, and scientists are growing this in the lab to better understand diseases, and especially neurological diseases. So after the break, I want to find out more about the ethics of this, of course, from our guests, but also the potential for such research, especially when it comes to the applying the possible results of these studies in clinical settings. Keep it here on Health and Living, PFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. Dr. Azina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist, is joining us today for her monthly brainwave segment, and she's also joined by Associate Professor Dr. Michael Ling, developmental neurogeneticist from University Putra, Malaysia. And we're discussing growing brain cells in a petri dish, essentially, to put it very, very simplistically. But not to worry, you know, both Dr. Azina and Dr. Michael have explained how scientists have been working on growing these brain organoids, and they are derived from your stem cells. You know, no scientist is sort of growing these from brain cells from people. And you know, they were both sharing how it is sometimes a misnomer to call it a mini brain, because if you look at it, it doesn't resemble an actual brain at all. But it is the brain cells that we're talking about. You know, Dr. Azina, you also briefly mentioned this, and I think so did you, Dr. Michael, that these can, you know, the recent research have really looked at how these brain organoids can help us to understand neurological diseases. Dr. Michael, do you want to expand more about that? You know, why grow brain organoids, and how do these studies help us when it comes to treating diseases or perhaps even curing them someday?
I might be biased, but I'm certainly think that brain organoids is a better model to study human disorder, especially the brain disorder itself. So the issues with one of the issues that Dr. Azlina did mention is that we can't really study the brain cells directly on many patients. I mean, living patients I'm talking about, because we do have the capability to study the post-mortem brain of patients who have passed. However, in order to study the disease mechanisms, the onset, as well as the pathogenesis of this brain disorder, we will need to look into a living brain, a living disease brain. And we have these limitations where bound by various medical ethical issues that we cannot get access to a living brain in order to study these particular mechanisms. So why organoids become such an important replacement in that sense is that, first thing, as I mentioned, these organoids is in fact very powerful in order to study the developmental processes of the brain. And many diseases were in fact now but found to have the so-called developmental events or early events that happens during the very early stage of development. Disease such as autism, Down syndrome, neuropsychiatric disorders such as schizophrenia, bipolar, and depressions, they all have early events that happens at the developmental stages of development. So we don't even know some of these individuals basically have diseases like schizophrenia or bipolar until they reach early adolescence. So in order to study the early events as well as developmental processes in the womb that may have already happens in the womb, the only way is to harvest the cells from this patient. And this doesn't have to be the brain cell now. We can harvest the skin cell and turn them into stem cell. And from stem cell, we can differentiate them into brain organoids. So once they are, once they have turned into brain organoids, now this model allows us to recapitulate the developmental event that may have already, that related to the disease that have already happens at a very early stage of their life. So that's the reasons why I think the brain organoid is a better model to study human disorder, especially those have developmental components in its onset and progressions. And in addition to that, they are always have a lot of argument in terms of why we use animal and how well this animal resemble human, as well as human cell or human diseases, and how translatable is these findings that we have seen in the animal cells or animal models into the human setting, I mean the clinical setting for human beings. So this is one of the reasons why, of the many reasons why, we think the organoids will provide a better avenue to study a more complex disorder such as what I have mentioned that relates to schizophrenia, bipolar, Down syndrome, or autism.
Yeah, maybe I can also add on. I think that's a really great explanation, Michael, and it just sort of reminded me of a paper actually that was looking at motor neuron disease. And of course, you know, in some cases, like these later onset neurodegenerative diseases, you know, you only start to see the symptoms, you know, after decades of life, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. And I guess there's always been the question of, well, when do the neurons start getting sick? You know, when do the wrong things start happening inside the neurons and the other brain cells? And that's still a question that we don't fully know. But in this recent paper by a group in, I think, Cambridge, they were looking at this motor neuron disease, and they used these brain organoids from a patient that carries a specific genetic mutation that can increase their risk of getting motor neuron disease. And they could actually see, even at the very earliest stages, like what Michael mentioned, you know, because these brain organoids actually represent quite an early stage of development, not a mature brain, right? So they can already see that there are changes that are happening inside the cells. And that's really going to be something very important because, of course, with a lot of these, you know, brain diseases, we're always thinking about how can we treat them better. And if there is, you know, a stage at which we can catch that disease before the cells are just too damaged, you know, that we just can't do anything with them or can't stop the progression of the damage, then, you know, if we can pinpoint the earlier stage and what's going on there, then that's, you know, potentially going to be very useful as well for treatment later on.
Mm, that's fascinating because it allows scientists to sort of just follow along that progression, right? Instead of just seeing how it presents in patients or perhaps when you are able to, if you are able to study someone's brain after they've passed on, it's a totally different perspective to better understanding the disease. But let's talk about the ethics of it. You know, we are talking about brains. I do have to ask both of you about the consciousness aspect of it, unfortunately. We are talking about clumps of cells, right? But could they develop consciousness? You know, is that something that scientists who are working on this, that's something that they're constantly concerned about?
It really depends on the definitions of consciousness. From the scientist's point of view, we define consciousness in a particular organism based on how densely a particular neuronal networks are connected across the brain and how these neurons interact, and in terms of the degree of activity and interactions that eventually used to define whether or not an organism is conscious. So there's a cutoff point for that. We call it, it's a score of P, but more than zero, then this organism is considered conscious, for example. However, some people also define consciousness as simple as a brain that can receive an input and eventually also give an output, means that, you know, you talk to the brain and the brain react to it in a way that you would able to understand. So this brings us to an analogy. So do we think a fly a conscious organism? Of course, we think a fly is a conscious organism, right? I mean, that unable to measure how they feel pain doesn't mean that they are not conscious. They still react to when we try to smack them, they try to fly away. So they are conscious. And then if we think fly is a conscious organism, and if we compare their brain activity to the organoid's activity, then organoids can be also conscious just based on those information itself. But do they really conscious? I guess it depends on the state of the organoids and how long they have been, in fact, grown, and whether or not they have been given the accessories to read the inputs from the environment. And then whether or not they have been given the accessory for us to understand their output as a response to the environment. So I would like to bring an example from Alison Moultrie. So Alison Moultrie is a very famous scientist working in the field, and he's from University of California, San Diego. And he basically tried to make a conscious brain organoid. And of course, in order to do that, he tries to grow the organoids so that the organoids will have good enough connectivity, and also emit this so-called brain wave that resembles an infant's brain wave. So this is this is defined as consciousness according to his lab. And of course, to make it more interesting, Alison Moultrie is trying to give a body to these organoids. So whatever electrical activity that's happening in this little clump of cell is now connected to all of these many electrons. And these brain activity, the so-called organoid electrical activities, are then read and interpreted and translated into a robot. So now a robot will then move around, jiggle around based on the electrical activities of these brain organoids. And to make it more interesting, so they're trying to give input to the brain organoids by putting a camera to this robot so that now the robot can see things and all these images are translated into input and which is then translated into electrical stimulations that stimulates the brain organoids so that the brain organoids now get so-called stimulations based on what is seen through the camera on this robot and they will react by sending back some sort of electrical responses where change the movement of the robot. So now they can also train the robot so that they won't drop off the cliff of the table or whenever they see this a so-called barrier or resistance, they will change their directions. And the question is, will all these input and output of environmental signals eventually train the organoids to be more independent and eventually they can end up thinking for themselves? That is certainly a long way to go. But in long run, I think they can turn conscious in a specific setup and scenario.
Mm. But if scientists find that these organoids do gain some level of consciousness, can such such research continue? Or is that, or will they have to halt it for ethical reasons?
I would like to also bring another examples, for example, Nanan Sestan from Yale University. So he works with pig's brain, which has been removed from the organism, and try to maintain the brain outside the body by restoring all this neural activity. And at one point, their group basically found that the pig's brain basically started to emit EEG patterns that resemble a living human being. So what they have actually done immediately, because they thought that they will be able to achieve that, and they did. And one of the things that they do is to cease the project immediately and put that project at halt by putting the brain into sleep by giving the brain anesthesia. No one's really known what would happen to a single brain that are not connected to any bodies, right? Any responding body, for example, like how we can respond, because we do have our motor system, our hand, our limbs that respond to it. But for a single brain, the question is, what if this brain attain consciousness and can hear us or can feel pain? And that is where the ethical issues come through. You know, can we still continue experimenting with them? And is it humane to basically, for example, working with brain organoids derived from human that eventually already have consciousness? So certainly that will bring in a lot of issues. And in the United States, as one of the most advanced country that leading various ethical regulations as well as guidelines, mm-hmm. they do not have any guidelines just yet to basically regulate consciousness study, and any lab can still try to grow any brain organs that basically eventually can attain consciousness. I guess the issue is they have not reached that level, so there is no need of such regulations. But yeah, it's just a matter of discussion. What would happen if we basically make these organoids become conscious one day?
Do you think, reaching that point where organoids may become conscious, is that still far away in research?
I think it's very hard to predict. These organoids, although like what Dr. Aslina has mentioned, it takes place, the entire technology took place many decades ago. Mm-hmm. And it was in 2013 when Madeleine Lancaster from Cambridge University published the paper on how to grow this organoid on a dish, and that revolutionized the methods and makes everyone now can grow these brain organoids easily on a dish. So I would have to say, and ever since then, there are so many groups in the States that are now going and growing the brain organoids in a different way. For example, organoids can be primitive, but now they try to grow different parts of the brain and try to puzzle them together to form a more complete brain. For example, we have our frontal lobe, we have our midbrain, we have our hindbrain. And this is what is being done in many groups in the States, especially in the Sergio Pascal group. They try to grow brains from different regions independently. And then they try to join them together to form a more wholesome brain organoids. And they call it as an assembler because they assemble it together. And they have actually gone to the stage where they assemble multiple regions of the brain to a spinal organoid. So you don't just grow organoids for just brain. I mean, you can grow organoids for different parts of the, I mean, for different organs in the body. So they also grow an organoid out of the spinal cord. And they also grow an organoid out of a muscle tissue. So now you have this brain, you have a spinal cord, and you have a motor organoid. And Sergio Pascal from Stanford basically joined all of them together to form a complete a neuronal motor system to study a neuromuscular disorder. And you can go up to the system in such a short period of time to study a systemic organoid. And I think getting and attaining an organoid with conscious, it's just a matter of time. I don't think it's going to be far away from now.
That's supposed to look really interesting and also quite mind-boggling, I think, because, you know, it's the kind of things that people think only exist in your movies or in your science fiction.
Yes.
Dr. Azlina, how do we balance the benefits of what we can learn from brain organoids with the potential ethical concerns that emerge from these research?
I mean, you know, people are always going to be driven by curiosity, mm-hmm. you know, and there's still, I mean, the brain itself is such, you know, an enigma, and there's so much that we need to learn. And, you know, inevitably, when technology allows you to do something, you're constantly going to be pushing that boundary. And you know, that's just how science goes, right? I do think that, what Michael said, of course, is correct. And you know, the scientists, when we do our research, you know, we are bound by ethical guidelines and what we can and cannot do. So, of course, you know, those are going to be things that we abide by as scientists in our own lab. But, you know, sometimes you do have to sort of push things. I mean, I think a larger conversation, I'm not going to be able to give you an answer, but, you know, a larger conversation, obviously, needs to be had. I mean, when Michael was talking about, you know, whether or not they're conscious, and I could just sort of imagine, you know, us kind of like, you know, coming together and having a talk and just sort of saying, well, what exactly is consciousness, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think as well, people haven't quite agreed or don't quite exactly know how to define it, you know? And so perhaps different people may define it differently. So, in terms of kind of answering, coming back to your question, but in terms of if there are sort of straightforward questions that we can answer using this technique, then I think that's going to be a very attractive option, right? Where we want to know something like if a person has a genetic mutation, how does that actually cause the disease to progress? Why does it progress faster? So if we have sort of set straightforward questions that we can answer from these brain organoids, and if the answers that come from there can also then help in terms of future therapy, then I think then that's very justified, right? But of course, all the work needs to be done within, you know, a very strict ethical framework. And as Michael said, you know, I mean, people are still trying to figure it out at where exactly do they draw the line at the moment. Yeah. So, it's a conversation that scientists across the world need to have.
Yeah. And it's always a balance between the costs or the concerns, but also with the benefits, right? Because like you said, there's so much we don't know, and we're talking about diseases, disorders that are still incurable and that significantly affects people's quality of life. So, you know, there's so many questions that remains to be answered.
Yeah, I mean, like, to give you an example, I mean, I think this sort of, you know, before the brain organoids even became a possibility, you know, people tried to do things like they would mix kind of human cells with animal cells, and then they would grow it, mm-hmm. you know, then they would grow that and create a chimera. And that was to sort of try to get around, you know, not being able to grow cells within a certain time point for stem cells. So like I said, you know, people are constantly going to be trying to push the boundary to answer these questions. And ultimately, it's, you know, to be able to answer how do we understand developmental processes, you know, in case, you know, you have neurodevelopmental diseases, and how do we create better treatments and understand the progression of these neurodegenerative diseases better.
Hmm. Dr. Michael, are there any areas of research that are promising or that you look forward to when it involves research in brain organoids?
Yeah, there's certainly plenty at the moment, given that the emergence of this particular technology now, people basically see various complex disorder in a different way. We have been able to only study complex diseases, neurological disorders such as Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson, or the malcognitive impairment, schizophrenia, bipolar, in a way that from the behavioral point of view, we have been doing our study in such a way, and we have been able to study the disease based on their past family history as the patients was telling the doctors. But now with the organoids, we will be able to see what was actually happening during the early developmental stages or even before the onset of any visible symptoms that can be diagnosed by the doctors. And in fact, I would like to give an example. For example, the Alzheimer's disease organoids that we basically grow in the lab when I was back in the state. These organoids basically not just having the neuropathology that resembles whatever we have seen in the Alzheimer's disease patient, but in fact, we also discovered that they have much more pathology that even happens at a very early developmental stages. For example, the neuroprogenitor cells, which is like a very early stage of neurons, okay, ancestor of the neuronal cell, they prefer to differentiate much faster compared to a normal cell. So it gives us an idea that perhaps it was the very early depletions of this so-called progenitor cell. It's just like a bank saving. Okay, instead of accumulate a group a sum of wealth in order to sustain your later day expenses, now we use up this sum of, this so-called saving much earlier time point, leaving nothing much there when it comes to a later stage of your life in order to replenish or to repair any potential damage that may have happens to the brain. And because of that, then, you know, these people develop Alzheimer-like, you know, neuropathology in the brain. So this is one of the, for example, a discovery that is never possible by looking into the post-mortem brain acquired from the patients themselves after they have passed on. Otherwise, without the brain organoids, we will never be able to see various mechanisms and disease progressions in the lab. So that is, I think, one of the greatest breakthrough, and is now being used to study not just Alzheimer's disease, but many disorder that opening the paradigm of treatments, because it seems like we need to diagnose the patients earlier, find out what the so-called biomarkers that we can actually detect at an earlier time point so that we won't miss the disease developmental, the important golden windows to infect, to treat them.
Mm. And what about for you, Dr. Azlina? You know, anything you're looking forward to?
I like the idea that Michael mentioned about the brain with the little robot. that would be great if I could kind of grow some of my cells and then, you know, get them to do all the the paperwork, and you know, I'll let them do all the paperwork and all that, and I can do the fun stuff. So, I think Michael sort of summarized it really nicely. You know, I guess because we work in kind of the medical field, we think about it more, you know, in terms of understanding and curing certain diseases. But you know, the sky is the limit, really. You know, in rehabilitation or things like that. Yeah, the future is interesting.
Just to add on to that, mm-hmm. So the neural robot was actually one of these Ellison Mortry so-called ideas, right? So just to add on that, Ellison Mortry's group is also growing organoids in the space. So he basically sent his brain organoids to the International Space Station, NASA, wow. Then grow their organoids in a shoebox, so-called incubator. Okay.
Yeah.
So they don't really need any maintenance from the space itself. So everything was regulated from from the ground so that the media are changed, the cocktail are changed, the waste products are removed so that these organoids continue to grow with the purpose of to study how microgravity affects brain development and function that we could not, we are not able to study on these astronauts who actually spend a lot of time in a space station. Of course, we can still study in terms of the neuroimaging, from the neuroimaging point of view, from the clinical assessment, behavioral assessment, but the molecular changes that happens to these people who work in the space stations can never be studied unless you have this brain organoid. And to be honest, in order to study any particular changes, we really need a full-blown human brain. Sometimes we don't need that. We just need to have a simple human brain organoid. And then if there's any changes happens to the very simple model, you will expect this actually a greater changes in the more complex brain in the human. So I think that is also very interesting to add on in terms of the breakthrough in the future.
I think it feels like there's so much happening, you know, Dr. Azina. Perhaps this is something that we need to revisit again in 2 years to see what more breakthroughs happen.
Yes. Absolutely.
This has been a thoroughly interesting discussion. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Azina and Dr. Michael.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Dr. Azina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist, for her monthly Brainwave segment. And this month, we are joined by Associate Professor Dr. Michael Ling, developmental neurogeneticist from University Putra, Malaysia. And we've been discussing brain organoids, you know, or the fact that scientists have been growing brain cells in their labs in petri dishes and the endless opportunities that this could hold, especially in the medical field. I'm Lim Suan, and this has been Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, PFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.